Have you wondered, where do we come from? Have you ever had trouble wrapping your mind around the idea that the Earth is billions of years old? Or that humans have only been around a fraction of the time? Are humans intelligent animals at the top of the food chain? Or are we more special than that? And whatever we conclude that we are, uniquely humans or highly evolved animals, where did we come from? And are we here for a purpose? This is Unlocking the Mysteries of Genesis. The mystery we want to unlock right now is, where did we come from? Not just you and me, but all of us, humankind. How did man begin? In the last episode, we talked about the origin of life in general and how it developed into more complex forms like plants and animals. This time, we're going to make it all about us. What are we? And how did we humans begin? And what makes us human?
Good evening, Calvary Castle Rock. Thank you for coming. This is going to be really fun tonight. We've had a good couple of lessons in the past, and I cannot wait to share with you what we have tonight on the video and the discussions about the video. So before we get started, last week, my wife had suggested that I should share my credentials, and I reached into my pocket and I pulled out a crumpled old post-it note, and I started reading it, and I heard several people chuckle. So I thought tonight I would show you that I really do have credentials. So the first one is University of Colorado. So there it is right there. Master of Business Administration. Again, I told you, I'm a businessman. I don't do this, but I do now, but I'm a businessman. So the next one is Creation Origins Matter. So this is the Institute for Creation Research School of Biblical Apologetics. It took me about six months to do the Origins Matter Course 1 and Course 2, and I completed it a year and a half ago. Next one. This is the Creationist Worldview. So this is, again, Institute for Creation Research, the School of Biblical Apologetics, and it's a certificate of completion for the Creationist Worldview. So that took me about a year and a half to finish. So I just wanted to start with those. You can take it down. I want to start with those because I had a post-it note, and I got a lot of chuckles out of that. So I thought, I'll just show that I actually do have a couple degrees in this stuff. So, but before we get started, I wanted to read an email question that I got sent to me. And I got sent a couple of really tough questions. I had about eight different questions from a couple of different people, and they were really good. So I wanted to share one of them and just to see so you can see what my response was and what we can learn as a takeaway from it. So let me read it. It says, you stated that humans are perfectly designed. How should we understand anatomical features like the recurrent laryngeal nerve, which seems inefficiently routed? Are these the result of the fall, or was it in our inherent genome to begin with at creation? So I gave an answer, and I wasn't happy with my answer. So my answer was something like this. It was, evolutionists think that we have leftover parts inside of our body, which they call vestigial organs or vestigial parts that were left over from evolution, and we just don't need them, and you can get them out of there. And what it would be, appendix would be a vestigial organ. You can live without it. Tonsils, wisdom teeth, you can live without those. By the way, I have my wisdom teeth, so I'm proud to say. But I wasn't really happy with that answer, and so I started to research a little bit about the recurrent laryngeal nerve. So I went on the Institute for Creation website. They've got Acts and Facts magazine that comes out, and it's a bunch of articles, comes out four times a year, and it's scientific articles about different topics. So I typed in laryngeal nerve, and lo and behold, I found three articles, and so I researched it a little bit more, And so I wanted to tell you what I learned about the laryngeal nerve, because it wasn't a result of the fall, the way it's designed. Now, when it operates improperly, that's a result of the fall, but not the design. So now I would not say, the evolutionists say the recurrent laryngeal nerve is a vestigial organ. They would not say that, because it has a very determined purpose, and it's not a leftover part, and it's necessary for us to live a normal, healthy life. So in the embryological development in the womb, the heart begins adjacent to the brain. It's way up here, like inside my head. And then it lowers during the development, and as it lowers down to the larynx down here, the nerve that is wrapped around it, the recurrent laryngeal nerve, begins to stretch. The RLN is what it's called. It has branches to both the brain and the heart, and it elongates as it stretches down to maintain its connection to the heart, brain, and other organs along the path. So the superior laryngeal nerve comes from up here right down to your larynx. The recurrent laryngeal nerve goes down. It's down in the center, goes down, loops up, and comes up. But during development, the heart, it starts up here and it slides down. And because of this nerve, and because of the length of this nerve, it enables it to stay connected to both the heart and the brain during the development process. So so there's another reason for it. So that's it could have been a design that God put in there so that he could develop the embryo inside the womb. There's also the issue of redundancy. It's protected from surgery accidents, and it's protected from car accidents. So a car accident or a surgery accident that severs the superior laryngeal nerve, it cuts off part of the voice. The superior is all about tone, all about pitch. It's all about pitch. The recurrent is about tone and loudness. So this nerve can get severed right here, and we wouldn't lose our voice. Our voice changes. We talk in monotone, but we don't lose our voice. We still have the ability to speak and communicate because it's redundant. There's another piece that's in a more protected inside part of your body rather than being outside exposed to injury. Okay, one last thing. So the RLN, the recurrent laryngeal nerve, it controls raspy versus a smooth voice. The SLN, the superior laryngeal nerve, controls the pitch, which I just mentioned a minute ago. And so what we talked about in the past is God loves variety. We all know that. So if you were to listen to Phil Wickham and Mac Powell and compare him versus Bono or versus Springsteen, completely different voices. They both have the pitch, but the laryngeal nerve changes what the tone is. So a raspy voice or a crisp, clean voice is determined by the laryngeal nerve. The same thing, Carrie Underwood and Taylor Swift versus maybe Adele and Janis Joplin, both produce music that people like, but completely different sounds. So those are a result of the recurrent laryngeal nerve, not the superior. Superior is pitch. The other one is smooth versus raspy. And so I just thought we'd point that out, because the question then becomes, is it poor design or is it masterful engineering? That's for you to decide. I don't know. But here's the takeaway. Don't take what the world says and they say, here's the reason why creation is wrong and God didn't design a perfect body, because this one he actually designed inefficiently. Don't take that at face value. Do some research, do your own work, and look and see if it's really true, because in this case, there could be some very other reasons. So that was the email that I got. If you wanted to ask me a question, I had it last week up, but this week I do not. It's Bara Ronald, 1965@gmail.com. BaraRonald1965@gmail.com. And if you email me questions, I'll do my very, very best to get back to you. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. And we'll start with Genesis 1:27. So God, Elohim, created man in his own image. In the image of Elohim, in the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. The triune God created us in his image. What we talked about in our first lesson is the Godhead is clearly seen, and we talked about that in Romans 1:20. Romans 5:8 says, "But God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Our Creator loves his creation so much that he came to redeem his fallen creation and his fallen creatures." Philippians 2:13. "For it is God who works in you both to will and to do for his good pleasure." This one's really cool, and we'll hear it a couple times tonight. But here's what I love. You see the word his is italicized. Is it italicized in the slide? No, it's not. In the Bible, it's italicized. That means it's not in the original text. It was added by a translator, a pretty good translation. But if you take it out, it expands the meaning, because we can take it out because it wasn't in the original text. So if you say to will and to do for pleasure, not just his good pleasure, but pleasure, that expands it. Pleasure to God. If we're in his will, doing his will, pleasure to us, pleasure to the people around us, to will and to do for pleasure. And I love that. So, tonight's big idea. Slide number two, please. Okay, there it is. Tonight's big idea, what is man? Humans are not just complex animals. We are purposely created in the image of God. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. So we got about a 4-minute video that we'll start off with, and go ahead and play that one.
For centuries, Western scientists answered this question with a worldview of science that was dominated by a biblical view of origins, that God, the designer, made man and everything we see. Scientists and theologians were not far apart on their thinking. Often, the theologians were the scientists, and vice versa. In the 19th century, that began to change. We've all heard of Charles Darwin's book, On the Origin of Species. In it, Darwin argued for evolution of life from simpler forms to more complex ones. But he stopped short of saying that apes evolved into people. 4 years later, in 1869, Thomas Huxley took that step and suggested that mankind also evolved and came from lower-level primates. His book, Evidence as to Man's Place in Nature, detailed this theory. His central thought was that anatomical similarities between humans and apes made evolution likely. Then, with that line of evolutionary theory already crossed, Darwin wrote his own sequel, The Descent of Man, now applying evolution to humans and contending that humans evolved from primates. From these authors came the basic assumptions of evolution. First, that all of life evolved over long spans of time. Second, that any differences between us are the result of natural selection and some adaptations and mutations along the way. Finally, that similar design means that we must have a common ancestor. We would expect that if we all came from one common creature way back when, then those creatures closest in line with us would have similar anatomy. So, let's see if that's what we find.
It was Huxley who looked at the similarities between humans and primates, which everybody else, in addition to Huxley, was seeing as well, and assumed that because we were most similar to them, therefore we were probably most closely related to them. And that notion has been perpetuated right up to now.
We find that, yes, of course, chimpanzees are bilateral animals. They have two arms, two legs, two hands, two feet, that sort of thing. But there is a lot more specific details that separates us from the chimpanzees.
Today, we have more sophisticated ways of determining the genetic makeup of an organism than by merely observing its external traits. Mapping of the human genome started in the 1990s. By 2003, researchers reported to have completed sequencing on the entire human genome, as well as some plants and animals. Genetic research continues today, and geneticists and other scientists are discovering new ways to apply this information to everything from disease therapies to genetically modified food crops. Although our understanding of how DNA works is growing exponentially, the basic principles of genetics are still the same. DNA is a macromolecule found in the nucleus of nearly every cell of every living thing, and it tells the cell what function to play. The DNA is packed tightly together into large units called chromosomes. Inside the chromosome is the heredity information that is passed from generation to generation. This information determines your physical attributes, like your hair color, how tall you might grow, your ethnic characteristics, even whether you will lose your hair. And on the most basic level, your DNA carries the information that determines what kind of organism you are. The key to what we are biologically, whether we are a person or an amoeba or a chimpanzee or a gnat, is written in the DNA. It's the blueprint of what we are.
So which worldview best explains our origins? Is it a biblical worldview, or is it an evolutionary worldview? Biblical worldviews dominated science until the mid-1800s. Darwin, in his book On the Origin of Species, says that life evolved from simple to complex forms. By the way, the book is On the Origins of Species. Never talks about origins at all. It skirts that and it goes right into evolution. Thomas Huxley in 1869, as he mentioned, theorized that we evolved from primates, that's apes and chimpanzees. Because of their observable external features, that's what they believed. They saw them, they say, hey, they have two eyes, two ears, swallow, breathe, just like we do. We probably came from them. Darwin quickly followed suit in his follow-up work, The Descent of Man. So slide number 3. Evolutionary theory assumptions provides an atheistic explanation that does not require a creator. That creator should be capitalized. My mistake. Life evolved from long ages of death and struggle through the process of natural selection. Selectionism credits outside forces for causality versus internal forces created by God. So they're saying nature is changing creatures and humans, not God. It sees adaptation as coming through beneficial random mutations versus programmed internal DNA that senses environmental conditions and subsequently adapts back and forth. The evolutionary worldview assumes we must have a common ancestor versus a common designer. It's because of the observed external traits. Today we have the advantage of technology mapping sequencing genomes. DNA determines what kind of creatures we are, whether it be humans, plants, dogs, cats, etc. The genomes within the DNA determines its attributes and its adaptability through continuous environmental tracking. We'll talk about that just for a second. We talked about it a little bit last time. Continuous environmental tracking is research that's being done by the Institute for Creation Research, and they're saying that our bodies are in alignment with engineering principles, and that coded within our DNA is the ability to epigenetically change, that's on and off, so that when we're continuously tracking the environment, so when the environment changes and the conditions change, what's built inside of us is the ability to adapt to those changes. We can adapt to it and we can adapt back from it. And we gave the example of oxygen in our blood cells, how we get more when we get at altitude, we get less when we go down. I just said this. The DNA is epigenetic. That means traits can be turned on and off. Thicker skin, fat storage, increased fur, increased red blood cells, etc. God gave us the purposely designed blueprint for life. So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to explore whether we share common DNA with apes and chimpanzees. So I want to ask some questions. If we do share, how much do we share? How many people would say we do share? Okay, 25%? 50%? 75%? 98%? We got some 98%ers out there. That's what we've been told, right? So the next video, 7-minute video, enjoy.
You may remember from science class that a DNA molecule has a double helix structure that looks like a twisted ladder. The ladder's rungs are made from 4 nucleotides known by their initials G, A, T, and C. They pair up with each other all along the DNA strand. An easy way to think of it is this. The DNA strand is made up of these 4 letters. Those letters make up words. Those words make sentences, the sentences, paragraphs. In this case, genes are the sentences and chromosomes are the paragraphs. The letters and the sequence of the letters are what determine what the organism is. From these letter combinations, you can make something complex like an encyclopedia or a human. Or you can make something relatively simple like a stop sign or yeast. When a geneticist sequences the genome of an organism, the result is an extremely long chain of letter combinations. So, when geneticists are comparing the DNA of 2 different species, they are comparing where these letters match and where they don't. So, if Huxley and Darwin's theories from the 1800s are correct, and we all have evolved from a common ancestor, today's scientific evidence should corroborate that humans and their animal ancestors share similar DNA. And that's what some scientists say they find.
So there's a very common belief out there that humans and chimps have evolved from a common ancestor. And so many times even humans are considered primates. Okay? And the reason for that is they say, well, you know, if you look at the DNA, humans and chimps are 98 to 99% similar. That's what you hear in the media. That's what you hear by many scientists, unfortunately. But it just is not the case.
Everyone hears that the chimpanzee genome is 98 to 99% similar to human. But what does that mean? Well, this is an area I've been researching for the past 4 years. And the one thing that I've found out is that these estimates are based on isolated segments of DNA that we share with chimp that are very similar. It's not based on the whole genome.
So, for example, a lot of the DNA that supposedly is the same between chimps and people would be for something like metabolizing foods, breathing in air, which we call respiratory physiology, and the various processes that not only chimpanzees and people have to undergo, but also mice and rats and all the other vertebrates in the world. We all have to digest food. We all have to breathe in the same air. We have to drink the same water. So, therefore, so much of the genetic material would necessarily have to be the same.
The human genome was sequenced first, and it took a very long time, and it took a lot of money. And the analogy that I like to use, it was like a giant jigsaw puzzle, okay? Because when you sequence human DNA, you don't get the 3 billion bases all in one nice strip, and you know how it all goes together. It's like doing a jigsaw puzzle without a picture to go by. You don't know what the final picture is supposed to look like. Well, when they went to do the chimp genome to save time and to save money, and based on the evolutionary assumption that humans and chimps share a common ancestor, they simply took the human DNA as a template or a scaffold, and they just lined up the chimp DNA with it. Now, is that really how the chimp DNA goes together? We don't know. And so there's just no evidence to support that humans and chimps share a common ancestor.
There's 900 million DNA letter differences between us as a species and chimpanzee as a species. That's a huge difference. At 1% of our sequence, we're 98% similar. Well, overall, we're 70% similar, and practically that means 900 million letter differences between us and our supposed closest evolutionary relative.
And the differences are too vast for evolution to work, for us to evolve from a chimp-like creature or a primate. It's just not possible. The genomes are that different.
So perhaps the genomes of chimpanzees and humans are not as close as we're led to believe. And as to those comparisons in anatomy that led Huxley and Darwin to contend that humans evolved from apes, let's take a closer look at the evidence.
Humans and animals have a lot of similarities, there's no doubt about that. But there are also a lot of important differences between humans and animals, and particularly between humans and chimpanzees. There are a lot of physical differences, which you can see in external anatomy, the body hair, the ability to pick and grab things with your hands. The humans have a specific muscle in their forearm, which gives them a unique capability to manipulate the tip of their thumb, which a chimpanzee doesn't have. And because we have that ability, we have a lot more creative ability with our hands.
Why does it matter if genetics proves that modern man evolved from chimpanzees? When it comes down to it, it's the difference between believing that humans are complex animals versus believing that humans are humans.
It's not just the external physical capacities that you see that make us different. Clearly, there is a major difference between humans and chimpanzees, and let's just jump to some of the obvious ones. Humans put men on the moon. Humans build hospitals. Humans use surgical instruments and operate on each other. Humans play baseball and go to ballets and write poetry. Humans do all of these things because there is not just a vast difference between us and a chimpanzee intellectually.
Beyond the physical, there are emotional and intellectual differences between humans and animals. A Labrador Retriever, for instance, has been bred to favor the genetic disposition to fetch. He can be taught the command to fetch a ball. Or he can be taught that fetch means sit or roll over and play dead. The dog doesn't understand the meanings of the words fetch or sit. He's merely been trained to respond a certain way to a certain command.
Right.
A chimpanzee can be trained to use sign language to ask for a banana. But he can't put together a sentence about something more abstract, like, tomorrow I want apples. An African gray parrot has a vocabulary of up to 3,000 words, but the parrot is mimicking sounds. She can't construct meaningful, complex sentences from those words.
Okay, so now we have to get ready to answer the questions whether or not we came from a common ancestor. We believe we share some of the same DNA. And how much, and why does it matter? So we've all seen the evolutionary depiction of an ape evolving into man. Put up slide number 4, please. So we've all seen that. There was even a clip on the video. So we did a lot of study. We did a lot of empirical observation. We went in the lab. We counted the DNA. And we now know that this depiction is no longer true. So slide number 5 will show a more accurate depiction. Dave. So we got a surfer. We evolved into surfers. So now Pastor Winder, he took issue with this. He said, I'm not a surfer. I'll never be a surfer. I never was a surfer. I evolved way past that. So we went back to the lab. We studied the DNA and we have a much better depiction. And that would be an In-N-Out burger in his hand right there in that plate. Now, I'm not saying that's Pastor Winder. I would not say that. I'm just not going to say that. So, slide number 7. Yes, we do share similar DNA. 98% is true. We do share 98% similarity in isolated segments such as lung function, breathing, digesting, eating, drinking, the circulatory system, etc. The chimpanzee genome is, in these isolated cases, are 98 to 99% similar to humans. The problem is the number's been cherry-picked. It cherry-picked out of our common organs. We all breathe, we all eat, we all drink. Those are things that we have to do. We have circulatory systems. To the creation scientist, it is evidence of a common creator, not a common ancestor. Our isolated common segments to apes is 99% similar, but our overall, we're only 84% similar. And the question is, why does it matter? So now you say, okay, 84%, that's a lot of similarity. Now, that 16% difference is also a whole lot of differentiation. But let's talk about why does it matter. The evolutionary timeline does not allow enough time for the 16% separation in DNA between the apes and the man in order to have mutated into what we see today. They have to have 98 to 99% because all their models call for 5 to 10 million years of evolution. If we're not 98 to 99%, their models do not work. The timelines are completely wrong. If we're only 84% rather than 98 or 99%, it would be hundreds of millions of years in order to have the time to mutate in accordance with their model. So it throws their model completely out of whack. So what do? They cherry picked it. And they didn't tell us. And how would we have known? This information was coming out in the 1970s. So those of us who were around in the 1970s, we know what happened, where we got the news. We got it on the evening news. We got it in newspapers. We got it in encyclopedias. We got it in textbooks. Well, if the science was cherry picking the results and they put it in everything that we got our information from, we couldn't fact check them. We couldn't go on the internet. We couldn't check it out. We believed it. And why wouldn't we? It was not real science. And they slipped it in on us. And here we are years later. The genome did not get mapped until the early 2000s. They started doing it in the 90s, finished it in the 2000s. We know so much more than we knew back then, but it's not being acknowledged. So evolutionists originally claimed that humans evolved from apes. That was Huxley and Darwin. Now they say we and chimpanzees have a now extinct common ancestor. So it's extinct, so we can't study it. It's part of the evolutionary story, if you will. But what does the Bible say? That's what we're focused on, because our two presuppositions was Jesus, the Lord Jesus Christ, was the creator of the heavens and the earth and all that was made, and the Bible is 100% true, inspired, and we need to take it literally for what it says. So what does the Bible say? Let's look at John 1:12. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, to those who believe in his name. Let me ask you this question. Can something that is not human and has the ability to think like a human, do they have the ability to receive him? We are God's special creation, created in his image. Has nothing to do with biology. Has to do with our ability to have relationship with him and to commune and communicate with him. Our creator, the Lord Jesus Christ, gave his very special creation the right to do as such. So, 6-minute video. Let's go ahead and watch this portion.
Secular scientists try to explain the differences between humans and animals in terms of evolutionary development. But the Bible has a much simpler answer. See, while God created thousands of kinds of animals, he only created two, humans. This doesn't mean that animals don't have emotions and intellects. Oh, they most certainly do. But only humans were created in God's image.
So when we look at humans, you know, it's really interesting because even the simplest things are extremely complex. And one of the examples of that is the blood clotting pathway. Obviously, that's very important to us. So when we get a cut, the blood clots and we don't bleed to death. And when you look at how that happens, it's a chain reaction, so to speak, of many, many different proteins or what are called factors that are involved, that the end result, one kind of activates the next one, which activates the next one, and the end result is a blood clot. So by definition, the blood clotting system or the blood clotting pathway is irreducibly complex because it's made up of many different parts. And if even one part is missing, if even one factor is missing, blood doesn't clot. Those types of systems, those types of complex biological systems or irreducibly complex systems are very hard for evolution to understand how those things came about, because all they're really left with is mutation and natural selection. Those are the main mechanisms for Darwinian evolution. And natural selection, well, it only selects from what's there. It can't create anything either. It can't account for the origin of novel things or new things. It can only select or cull, so to speak, from the proteins or DNA or whatever it may be that's already there. So random mutations and natural selection, they can't do what evolution needs them to do.
Well, as Christians, it should really matter what our view is on the origination of human beings, whether we evolved from an ape-like ancestor, as is told in the evolutionary story, or whether we believe what the Bible tells us. Now, I want to make one thing really, really clear, and that is the difference between human beings and animals does not boil down to biology. We are not just more sophisticated animals.
Humans are humans, and animals are animals. That's not to say we don't share many characteristics with the animals on this planet. Our bodies are similar in many ways. Most mammals have 2 eyes, 2 ears, 1 nose, and 1 mouth, because God created that design for functional efficiency. But sharing similar features doesn't mean we're related. What makes us different from animals? One thing is, of course, our intelligence, and especially our ability to have the kinds of conversations that we're having now. Thoughts and ideas about life and its meaning. This is something very human and very unique, something that no animal shares with us. And it turns out that man's desire for meaning in life is what the Bible has said all along. One of the earliest statements about people in the Bible is Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God put Adam and Eve on earth to manage his estate, to hold dominion over the earth. All the plants, all the animals, all living things he entrusted to us. So did God put humans in their current form in the Garden of Eden on the 6th day of creation, as Genesis tells us? Or did we evolve over millions of years, our oldest life forms accidentally sparked into being from a primordial soup? Let's take a final look at this question by looking at a few of the problems with the theory of evolution.
3 points to remember as it relates to evolution. First, none of the major steps of evolution have ever been recapitulated in the lab. So whether we're talking non-life to life, or that first molecule to the first cell, or a bacterial cell to an animal cell, or single cell to multicellular creature, or jellyfish to something with a backbone, fish to land, you name it, any of those big transitions, never been recapitulated in the lab. Second thing is that evolution happens too slowly for us to observe, by the evolutionist's own admission. So when we're talking about the essence of evolution, what Darwin's really proposing, humans came from some ape-like creature. We never see any changes on that scale. We're talking about speculation about the past. We're not talking about real observations in the present. All we see is small changes. So that's the second big picture point to consider. And third, Darwin gave a test for evolution. He said if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not be built by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Roughly paraphrased. So he's saying, I'm trying to explain all of life. And if you find something, some species, some part of a species out there, that you can't build step by tiny step, then my theory is a failure. The inner workings of the cell, highly interdependent, complex. You remove one component, system collapses. You can't evolve the cell. The cell makes up all life on the planet. So by Darwin's own pen, evolution should be rejected.
God purposely designed his special creation with the intellect to have abstract ideas and understanding in order to have relationship with him. Evolutionary steps have never been repeated in a lab, as he just said. Abiogenesis or abiogenesis is non-life to life. It does not follow the scientific method The scientific method requires to be observable. Evolution is not observed. It needs to be tested. It's never been tested. It needs to be retested. Since it's never been tested, it's never been retested. And it has to be falsifiable. And what falsifiable means is we know every single step so well that the removal of any piece would cause it to fail. So it's none of the, it follows none of the rules that are needed to follow the scientific method. Evolution, as he said, is based on speculation of the past, and it believes the present is the key to the past, which is an evolutionary term known as uniformitarianism. And we're going to talk about uniformitarianism next week when we get into our next lesson. It's in the book of Peter, in 2 Peter 3:4, which we'll explore when we get together again. He said that scoffers will claim all things continue as they did since the beginning. And we'll talk about why that is wrong, because he's warning us against uniformitarianism. All things were as they were from the beginning. He ignores the worldwide catastrophic flood of Noah's days that was spoken of by Jesus. Slide number 9. And I read this to you last time, but I'll read it again. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modification, my theory would absolutely break down. Charles Darwin, Origin of Species. So given the discovery of the irreducibly complex mechanisms in biology that we can now see today, Darwin's theory should be rejected. As a matter of fact, if he were intellectually honest with what we know today, he would have rejected it as well. Scoffers in these days have become captive by their worldview. They stick to the party line because they don't want to be seen as zealots. They don't want to be isolated as crazy. They don't want to risk career suicide because they would be mocked if someone in the scientific community went out and said, evolution's not true. That's just not the case. Matter of fact, I mentioned to some people, all the scientists at ICR were staunch evolutionists while they were getting their education. When they got out, they started looking at the evidence and the real science and breaking it down themselves. Every one of them turned into young earth creationists. And we'll learn more about that as we continue on. So slide number 10, Romans 1:21-22. Although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. Slide 11. So this is the human eye. The adult human eye has 30 trillion irreducible complex cells inside of each human body. And of those 30 trillion irreducibly complex cells, each of them are containing billions of molecular machinery. Show the next picture. Here's a real picture close up, and it's just, I showed that just because it's kind of cool looking to be able to see inside a human cell. And they've got even more up close ones, but it doesn't have the round ball, so you can't tell it's a cell. So each cell can be described as a self-contained city with billions of processes within it. And these are biological processes. So imagine New York City as a cell. And as we're zooming down and on this cell, we get in there and we see elevators up and down. We see machines traveling across the cell, the state. We see buildings being manufactured and buildings making other machines. All these biological machines that you would see, they have underground systems. They have high-rise buildings. Everything you would see in a city is what you would see in a cell, all functioning and interworking and not colliding and being dysfunctional with each other. It's masterfully designed. And there's billions of these machine-like biological machines within the cell. Irreducibly complex. You take out one piece, the whole cell. So whole cell fails. Irreducibly complex. Masterful design. Okay. We've got about a 4-minute video here, I believe. Make sure I didn't skip any. I think we're good.
So, does it seem more likely that humans are uniquely made by God? That we have a special role to play here on Earth? Look at our magnificent ability, not only to think like a dog would think, but to think intelligently and symbolically, to think of the future and to imagine things beyond the here and now, the intellect to understand and the courage to explore the unknown. And what about our ability to feel empathy for others, to give of ourselves and help others with no earthly reward except knowing that it's the right thing to do? Consider for a moment our ability to create works of art, to write poetry, to sing, to dance. You know, as God's creation, humans are also unique in that we have a spiritual life, a connection to a perfect creator who has endowed us with responsibility for the whole of the earth. And that connection is God's desire for companionship with us. Now let that sink in for a moment. God made both animals and people, and animals are precious to God, but we humans are the only creatures that are created to have genuine, intelligent, compassionate fellowship with God. And here's the best part. This companionship, this fellowship with God, it's not just made for our statistical 72 years of life. It's intended to last forever. If there is a God who says that He made us and made us in His image, then our purpose becomes clear. Being made in God's image creates the potential for fellowship with Him. What Jesus did to provide salvation restores the fellowship. The Bible says, "But God demonstrates His own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." Romans 5:8. That's the source of meaning now. And it opens up an eternity that has a resolute future. I'll leave you with this. The Apostle Paul wrote to the Philippians the very same idea. "For it is God who works in you both to will and to do for His good pleasure." Doesn't that excite you? For His good pleasure. We bring God pleasure. Doesn't that boggle your mind? That's why He wants to be with us. And this should encourage us to soar in this life, empowered by a genuine relationship with God as part of His purposeful design that gives each of our lives meaning. And the key to understanding this, and even more, is to dig deeper into our origins, turning over every bit of evidence. Next time, we'll turn over the fossil record and see what mysteries we can unlock there. Until then, I'm Marcus Lloyd, and we're unlocking the mysteries of Genesis.
So we, as God's very special creation, were created in His image to have genuine, intelligent, compassionate fellowship with our Creator, the Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. He came and redeemed His creation. Christ died for us so that He could have compassion with us for all of eternity. We just saw in Romans 5:8, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He didn't wait till we were good. We're never good. He died for us while we're sinners. Philippians 2:13, to will and to do for good pleasure, both God's pleasure, our pleasure, and the pleasure of all creation. I love that. Who wouldn't want that? I think that's amazing. So if you want to know your Creator who gives and receives good pleasure, in a few moments, we're going to pray a prayer, and you can repeat this simple prayer, and you will know your Creator, and you'll have Him for all eternity, and you'll have pleasure, and He'll have pleasure. It'll be amazing. So I told you I'm a businessman, so I'm going to foreshadow what I'm going to pray, and it's going to be very simple. I'm going to say, you can pray to God, "Hey, I'm a sinner. I believe You sent Jesus Christ to redeem me from my sins. I accept that free gift. I ask him into my life to be my Savior. And guess what? You're done. So, okay, business side of salvation. There's five elements of a contract. Offer, acceptance. Those are pretty straightforward. Consideration. What's consideration? It's the price. Jesus was the consideration who was offered to us. Offer, exception, consideration, capacity, that means mental capacity, so you're in right mind, right frame of mind, and legality. So it's definitely legal. If there's an offer, an acceptance, a price paid that Jesus paid, you have mental capacity and it's legal, it's a binding agreement forever. So I'm gonna put that in the prayer, and if you're watching online or if you're here and you don't know the creator of the universe and you wanna have this reciprocal good pleasure relationship, pray that simple prayer I just laid out right there and you got it. And if you do it, tell somebody, because that'll be really important to tell somebody and then start reading in the book of John. When you're done with John, read John again, right, Dave? When you're done with John, read John again. Get plugged into a really good Bible-believing church. So anyway, we'll close in prayer in just a minute, but how great is that, that we bring God pleasure, which in turn gives us pleasure, which is pretty awesome. So slide 13, next week's big idea. Do we see buried clues? We're gonna be talking about the fossil record. The fossil record provides evidence for a great flood and it supports biblical history. So we'll get into flood a little bit in a future lesson at some point. We'll get into evidence of the great flood, the flood of Noah's day. But next week we'll get into it a little bit as we're discussing the fossil record. So.